The Vienna Game, written by Paratactician, read by Code Switch. Chapter 7, The Tower of Cats. The second walk was harder. Adrenaline had powered him from the villa. His legs had worked mechanically, lifting and falling, when the only direction was away. He'd put his head down and looked at his feet and kept up with Teresi, and slipped into a dreamlike state of perpetual motion. He'd felt, for a couple of hours, something almost like the medium, like his mind was driving, his body an irrelevance. He could have walked for nights. Once the new evening came, the meat settled back round him like a heavy coat in summer. He ached from the concrete, and his stomach was a snarl of pain. The ectasal sleep left him feeling raw and scraped down, and his eyes were gritty when he blinked. He needed coffee more than he had ever needed anything in the world. The foil strip of pills jabbed into his thigh every few steps, and he weighed up a blue, but there was the honey to consider. Could he even take them together? Would it make him sneeze out his brain and die? He realized he should have asked Kanaya, realized it was probably too late for that now. "Can I smoke?" he said. "What?" said Teresi. "Why are you asking me?" "Well, I don't want to, like," he felt silly, "give away our position." She yelped a little laugh. "Mr. Captor, we are walking fast in a straight line through partial cover. We're probably the only heat source with significant mass in half a mile. You can light 10 cigarettes if you want." She'd been a little weird since he woke up. Not grumpy, just distant. He guessed it was probably hunger, same as him. He left the cigarettes in his jacket pocket and tried to focus on where he was putting his feet. The town to the southeast was hardly worthy of the name, a single street of prefabbed cabins cutting a rough line of best fit through a poorly correlated scatter of lumpy low-blood hives. Teresi sat him on a bench under a tree and disappeared, to rematerialize in a couple of minutes carrying a paper bag and two beige foam cups of black coffee that steamed invitingly in the evening air. His nose twitched. She gave him both cups, flopped down, and rooted around in the bag until she'd extracted a loaf of heavy brown bread and a can of reconstituted fish paste and grub sauce. They took turns scooping the fish stuff out of the can with torn-off wedges of bread. The sauce was tangy and heavily salted, and the bread itself was dense and a little spongy, and both of them crammed fat handfuls into their mouths and chewed ravenously. When it was all gone, and Teresi had scraped up the last tiny shreds of fish with her claws, they sat side by side and drank the coffee, which was fierce and metallic and dreadful, and smoked, and she told him everything. "This is bullshit," he said, when she stopped talking. "How I wish that were so." "No, seriously, Teresi, I'm not trying to flick your horns here, but this is bullshit. You can't fucking catch an AI like it's the clap or something." "Wow," she said, and grinned. "What were you doing in cyberspace?" "I mean it, like, an AI can't even exist inside an organic cortex. That'd be like trying to download your music collection onto a plate of sausages." "Please do not mention sausages," she said. "I would do a very great deal for a plate of sausages right now, especially with butter." He tilted his head back to drain the last dregs of coffee. "I'm telling you, I know I've been having some weird-ass dreams lately, but there is no way I have a fucking AI living in my pan. It's not possible." "Fucking was never actually one of my core protocols," said a cool female voice in his head. "But I'm sure a man of your talent can bootstrap me somehow." He stood up very fast and said, "What the fuck?" Teresi blew smoke unconcernedly. "Hello," said the voice. "My name's Rose. I'm afraid I already know what yours is." "No," he said out loud, and then thought, "No, this is ridiculous. This is fucking ridiculous. Who the hell are you?" "I really am an artificial intelligence," it said calmly. "Surely that's preferable to the alternative, which is that you're undergoing a total psychological meltdown." "You can't be an AI," he thought furiously. "Brains don't fucking work like that." Brains also tend to explode when dosed with small quantities of mind honey, it pointed out, and yours is ticking along very nicely. It's rather comfortable, in fact. Firm, yet squashy in the right places. "Shall I leave you two alone for a while?" asked Teresi innocently. He jumped and looked down to see her watching him with unseeing lenses and a scarcely perceptible smirk. "Give me 2 seconds," he said firmly, and turned away. The street ahead of them was a deserted launching strip of dark soil and fierce green shadows. "How?" "To forestall your next few questions," said the voice. "Yes, you have been dreaming about me. No, I mean you no harm. No, I cannot take control of your conscious body without your permission. Yes, I can see through your eyes. Yes, that was the worst coffee either of us have ever tasted. Yes, I can feel everything you feel, to some extent, at least. And yes, that does raise a number of intriguing possibilities, all of which I'd be happy to discuss with you later." He sat down again, hesitant, like a man expecting something to hurt. Teresi was still gazing at him, but the smirk had gone. There was something crooked and almost soft in the line of her mouth. "It's weird, isn't it?" she said. "That," he said fervently, "is a fucking understatement. And you've got one too?" She nodded. "Yep. He has been with me ever since the army. I am very fond of him." And, to his astonishment, she reached up and stroked 2 fingers gently down her own cheek, an easy little gesture, habitual and private. He went for the cigarettes and stopped halfway, suddenly panicked. "Go ahead," said the voice, teasing. "They're not my lungs." He tapped a diamond clear of the packet and moved it to the corner of his mouth with a trembling hand, but didn't light it. Then he thought of something and took it out. "How did you get yours?" he asked. "Like, how did you pick it up?" "Him," she corrected. "Yeah, okay, whatever. Had you been in the medium?" "No, I was in the middle of a firefight, as it happens. Things went wrong, and I went blind and passed out, and when I woke up, he was there." "How did you go blind? You never told me." "I lost my optics," she said ruefully, and looked up. He winced. "Fuck, that's nasty. But there's no way you could have been exposed to... unless... hang on, what happened to your optics?" "I had to take them off. My squad's helmsman caught a viral strike, and..." "It came out through the net, right? You guys use compound mind tech. You're all hooked up. It would have bled through the links, and..." "Yeah!" He flung the empty coffee cup away excitedly as the pieces fell together and twisted on the bench to face her better. "Let me guess. The virus that hit you was some weird-ass Outer Empire shit, right? Some grungy old pan-breaker, like rudimentary bleed-out-your-ears stuff." "Sadly, I was too busy going blind to be an enormous nerd," she said, but she sounded amused. "But we were a long way from Alternia, yes, the Mechbuddha group." He nodded. "Nobody uses stuff like that anymore, it's too obvious. Like, unless you get exceptionally fucking lucky, the most you're gonna take out with a pan breaker is a single squad, and then it runs into the sand. The real money's in the slow-burning stuff you can propagate around a ship or city before people start dying. But what it does is inflict instantaneous neurological trauma, bit like what I caught when I got blown to fuck." "Brain damage." "Yeah, it literally rewires your brain. Course, about 2 seconds after it gets rewired, it turns into grub soup and runs out your nose, but technically, if you cut the signal fast enough, you could take the hit and survive." He hunched forward and wagged the unlit cigarette at her. "But you'd still be left with a sponge for a brain, at least figuratively speaking. Holes where there shouldn't be holes. That's how your AI dude got in. I'm the same. The systems crash turned my pan upside down and shook it. We both got fucked up brains, that's why they picked us." "Mr. Captor," she said, "you are killing the romance." "Quite," said Rose, sounding a little hurt. "I assure you I picked you for a number of reasons, of which your undeniably fucked up brain was only one." "But it's fucking incredible," he said, to both of them, sort of. "Imagine, you get shot in the head and don't die. The slug misses anything crucial and gets lodged in some gunk you didn't really need, and okay, maybe now you get headaches and you can't count backwards from 20 without tasting raspberries, but who gives a fuck?" He plugged the diamond back between his teeth long enough to light it, cupping his hand round the flame, and hooked it clear again between two fingers. It ticked with the beat of his heart. At this point, most people are already like, man, way to flip off probability. But it turns out now you've got a lump of metal in your pan, you can pick up fucking radio waves. You got shot in the brain and all it did was turn you into a fucking home entertainment center. He took a shaky drag on the cigarette and puffed the smoke from both nostrils so it curled back up in clouds. So there you are lying on a battlefield, all AI compatible all of a sudden, and you pick up a knight, cause that's where knights hang around, right? And me, I take my inviting new pan off exploring somewhere I've never been, and I end up with a seer. I mean, fuck. She smiled, not her usual toothy grin, but something smaller and quieter. If only you'd been there to explain all this at the time. If I'd fucking been there, you'd still have both eyes, he said angrily. You got taken out by the tech version of a rusty knife with tetanus. Remedial level shit. If the army actually gave its helmsman more than, like, half a sweep's training, they'd stop shit like that cold. I'd have turned it round and fired it back down the net with a fuck you attached, and you'd still be running around blinking at kittens or whatever. He dragged on the cigarette again, trying to force down the sudden rage that had swirled together in his lungs. Then I am glad you were not there, she said, and he looked at her. Because I would never have met my cool kid, and that would be very sad. She reached out and put her hand carefully over his, where it gripped the crusty wood of the bench between them. Her skin was cool and dry. But I hope it won't sound too feeble if I say I do wish you had been there immediately afterwards. They took the tunnels back to town. Terezi said a commercial flight was too exposed, and the voice in his head agreed with her. It was a 5-hour journey. When they changed from the periphery to an axial line, they had a 20-minute wait at the Nexus, a long concrete platform scattered with broken glass and lit by inadequate arc lamps. It was deserted. The air was damp and cold and smelt strongly of oil. He sat on a bench with the craggy in its backpack propped against his knees, the tube of mind honey tucked safely in an inside pocket, and smoked. Terezi prowled up and down, peering at garish posters like she could read them. Then she used a combination of small change and vigorous kicking to prevail upon an old-fashioned vending hull, which whirred reluctantly and spat out a rubberized pod of sticky, jellied candies. They spent a happy 5 minutes silently skewering candies on their claws, sugary worms in toxic green and urgent red, and chewing. Terezi displayed an unerring accuracy for the red ones. "How can you even fucking tell the difference?" he complained. And she just licked her lips at him. When they reached the city, she insisted they check into a hotel. She picked one in an upmarket district west of the spires, got them 2 adjacent balcony rooms on the 10th floor. She gave the guy at the desk false names like she'd been saving them up just in case, which she probably had. The lift was mirrored on 3 sides and smelt of synthetic air freshener. His room was opulent. Tasteful bronze effect uplighters, fleecy white carpet, heavy curtains. He threw the keycard onto a table, then unhooked the backpack and dumped it on a fat purple armchair. The aircon unit high on one wall whirred into life as its sensors flagged up the temperature spike. A recuperacoon you could swim in was positioned dead center, surrounded by its own little island of dark-veined marble tiles and a freestanding chrome towel rail with a heater dial. The sopor was a brilliant concentrated green and gleamed invitingly. He stripped off jacket and t-shirt and flung them on the bathroom floor, splashed water on his face from the basin. His arms ached. He glanced over at the shower, which was spacious and had about 5 different nozzles and probably played music or something while you were in there, and then glanced away as quickly, remembering. Salix, said the voice in his head, gently. It's quite all right. I've been in your head for 2 weeks now. I'm afraid you really don't have many secrets left. He saw himself in the mirror, sharp-limbed and awkward, and felt a dreadful hot surge of humiliation, tried not to think about what else she must have seen and felt. There's really nothing to be ashamed of, she said. I am an artificial consciousness. Even were I programmed to notice your high cheekbones and the pleasing way the belt of your jeans doesn't quite hug your perfectly flat abdomen, creating a seam of shadow between fabric and warm skin that a cool little hand could just perfectly ease down into, such matters would evoke no response other than a detached, almost geometric appreciation. He stared furiously at the row of complimentary soaps, and she laughed. You can have a shower.
Nope, he said. Hell with that. I'm gonna go put my shirt back on.
And then what? She said. Renounce personal hygiene as the devil's work? Buy a wetsuit? You're going to want a shower eventually. Think how good hot water's going to feel as it sluices down your chest and beads in the stubble on your jaw.
Fuck's sake, he said,
and pinched the bridge of his nose. Let's just have a drink, all right? He scooped up a heavy glass tumbler from the shelf above the sink and went to root in the minibar. There were several small green glass bottles of beer, which sang him a plaintive song, but he couldn't quite bring himself just to grab one without asking. He hesitated for a second and then thought, awkwardly, "What'll it be?" "Listen very carefully," said the voice, cool and steady, "and do exactly as I say. Take out the gin, the vodka, the tequila, and the white rum miniatures. Good. Now tip them all into the glass. Now, is there any lemon juice?"
"Got some lemon and lime low-orbit bombardment Faygo," he thought.
"Christ. Oh well, put some of that in, and some of the Coke."
"The what?"
"The red can."
"Grub cola," he thought, and did as he was told.
Fuck, there's not much space.
"Just put as much in as will go. That's perfect. Now give it a stir."
He glanced around, snatched up one of the free hotel pens, and swirled it around in the glass, which turned a sort of murky golden-brown color. He lifted it and regarded it nervously.
"Man, to hell with it," he said out loud, and bobbed the glass pointlessly in the air. "Cheers."
"A votre santé," said Rose. He took a swig.
"Motherfucker," he said weakly, and coughed.
Someone rapped vigorously on the door. He crossed and thumbed the panel, which gave him a grainy green image of Thérèse from above and to the left. She looked up and stuck her tongue out. He opened the door. When she was inside the room, he handed her the tumbler and said, "Hey, try this." She sniffed, sipped, and said with some feeling,
"Oh, my God."
"Yeah."
"What do you call it?"
"No fucking idea," he said.
"What do we call it?"
"Lalande Island iced tea," said the voice. He reported this faithfully. Thérèse frowned.
"Cool kid seems to think that's hilarious," she said.
"I don't get it," he said.
"Nor do I."
They looked at each other, perplexed.
"Did I just manage to tell a joke neither of us understood?" he said.
"Now he wants me to bump my fist against yours," she said, "but this is getting very confusing, so I'm going to ignore him." She snared the glass off him and took another sip. "Put your jeans back on, we have work to do."
"I'm wearing my jeans," he objected.
She tutted.
"Cool kid," she said, exasperated, and gave him back the glass.
"Sorry, he does this sometimes." They moved through the city like they had nothing but time. Walked to a tunnel mouth, rode 3 steps, changed 2 more steps, got out, and walked again. Thérèse strolled along, pointing at things in windows, apparently at random, and making inconsequential remarks. Celix's neck prickled, and he forced himself not to glance from side to side more than he absolutely had to. Every muscle in his body twinged to optimize. Find target, head straight to target, minimize delay. But she was the urban gorilla, and she knew her game. He tried to get into the rhythm and see it as a shopping trip, except he'd always hated shopping, so that didn't really help. They browsed past the electric blue oblongs of shop displays, past carts hawking sugared mealworms and kebabs rolled in dark grease that made Thérèse's head swivel like a magnet, down churning argon colonnades where gusts of rain splattered the flat plastic canopy and fizzled off field generators. As they walked, the city grew dirtier and more tangled.
Wide avenues swung them into crooked back streets, and the babble of late-night shoppers faded into the clatter of kicked cans and solitary yells from windows somewhere overhead. He was glad he had left the backpack with his rig at the hotel. When they rode the tunnels, he clung to a slippery white plastic strap hanging from a central beam, the pistol in his jacket heavy by his heart, and every time the car lurched, Teresi bumped against him, so close he had to be careful of her horns. He thought her hair still smelt of smoke. They disembarked at last outside a hive stem Selix might have passed 20 times, or never. The street-facing walls were rough glaucrete, tagged to just above his head height, with blocky glyphs in black and scarlet. From there they rose bleak and green in the first pale shiver of dawn. One rusted door was shut, its glass pane milky and spidered with thin white cracks. The other hung open into darkness. "Please tell me we're not fucking going in there," he said fervently. She grinned. "No," he said. "No way. Absolutely not. Do you know where we are? I grew up in a shitty part of town, and this place makes it look like the Violet Mile. You walk into a stem around here, you'll leave slowly, bit by bit, depending on how much bile sacks are fetching on the market that week." "Well, I am going in," she declared. "So you are going to have to come along and keep me safe." He snorted. "What'll you do, pick me up and hit the first guy with me?" "No," she said, affronted. "You'd break. Although, I suppose then I could stab the next one with your legs." He followed her through the doorway and into the dark. The air was cold and stank of stale cigarettes and piss. The floor felt gritty under the soles of his boots. It was pitch black. He could stay put for 5 minutes and he'd still be working with basic shapes. 10 steps inside and he'd already lost the back of Teresi's jacket. "Would you like some help with that?" inquired the voice in his head politely. He twitched and then felt stupid. "Ah," he thought. "I guess. What are you going to—" An abrupt urge to blink seized him, like dust in his eyes. He did so several times, and when his vision cleared he was looking through pixel-sharp augmented optics at a green and black lobby, all harsh angles and fans of shadow. He could see grub cans and a bottle on the floor, the ruins of a deck chair. They were at the bottom of a 6-walled concrete shaft like a cistern, with iron-slatted stairs winding up the inside. Each few steps turned into a short gantry and a single door before moving on. It was a lot like the first stem he'd ever lived in, except bigger and more dilapidated. Teresi was headed for the bottom of the stairs. He wondered what had happened to the lighting. "How did you do that?" he thought. "It wasn't hard," said Rose. "I just uploaded the standard military AO trait to your cortical implant. It's like using a plug, except you don't actually need a plug." "What, you just had it lying around?" "I was a database," she said. "I have all the standard traits built into my architecture. Languages, competences. I can give you a new abstratus if you'd like. Look, try this one." His eyes snapped shut. He stood in a wireframe void, ghost blue, feeling his arms and shoulders flex like they were shaking off old sleep. Mannequins loomed from the front and the side, and he knew it like the alphabet. Straight arm block, knee block, slip to clear the elbow, back fist for distance, rise. "Are you all right?" murmured Teresi. He opened his eyes and stared wildly down at her. Her face was picked out in vivid green like a contour map. Blank planes for her lenses and black for the slivers of her hair, tiny upturned nose. He noted automatically that she'd stepped in too close. Her left knee was asking for a strike. "I know kung fu," he muttered. She cocked her head on one side, puzzled, and said, "Show me later." They went up the stairs. There was no point in stealth. The metal slats were worth 1,000 alarms. They groaned like dying graze beasts if you so much as looked at them hard. Progress up the stem was a new wave recital of clangs, creaks, rattles, and the occasional alarming crunch, echoing gaily up above them to make sure everyone was good and ready for guests. Solix, who had wasted too much of his adolescence gripping sweaty plastic guns in the argon gloom of arcades, kept expecting doors to burst open and tough guys to pop out with rocket launchers. Teresi trotted along with her hands loose at her sides like nothing would please her more. They didn't talk. When they'd been climbing for a little while, they emerged into a kind of mezzanine, a larger gantry, made of the same perforated metal, which stretched across half the shaft's width. There was enough floor space for a good-sized respite block. Squatted in the middle of the gantry, gazing at them, was a teenage troll. He was maybe 7 sweeps and already solidly built. A ragged, sleeveless tunic left his arms bare. He had a mane of shaggy hair held back from his face by a strip of fabric tied around his forehead. Both wrists were wrapped with tight black tangles of wire. A row of tiny acid-green LEDs had been implanted into the muscle of his right forearm, and they pulsed with his heartbeat. 2 pointed ears jutted from the curls on top of his skull. The troll bared his fangs and hissed. Teresi stopped. Solix did too. The hiss turned into a kind of purring growl, and the kid dropped forward onto his hands as though he were about to crawl or pounce. "Teresi?" said Solix. Something moved, and he glanced right to see a skinny girl with one side of her scalp shaved bare sidle out of the shadows. She was almost naked, wearing just a black vinyl skirt sliced into wide strips, and her torso was hatched with jagged glyphs, the spiky, scrawling kind favored by a lot of low-city bars. 2 thick striped cables jutted from the stubble above her left ear, looped back over her shoulder, and disappeared. A little higher, he could see the same pointed ears, attached to a plastic hairband. She had a knife. Teresi shifted, fractionally, and the air went sluggish. The boy with the lights threw back his head and howled. Anywhere else it would have sounded stupid. Here, in this cold green well of shadows and no wind, it was weird and dreadful. The howl bounced and shuddered up the tower, and all above them doors began to click open, gantries creaking and clanging under new weight. Faces peered over handrails. He heard muttering, the clink of a chain. The girl with the knife hovered out of arm's reach and licked her lips. Teresi's right hand slid into her jacket almost caressingly, and Solix yelled, "Hey!" That echoed, too, less creepily, but just as loud. The boy and the girl stared at him. The clattering above them stilled. "We don't want any trouble," he called. The hollow core of the stem gave his voice a depth and resonance it didn't really deserve. He spread his arms, slowly, hands open, fingers splayed. "We're not here to hurt anybody, okay? We just want to see the Prophet. Just see him, that's all." The girl with the scalp plug stepped in closer at that, and he forced himself not to flinch. She sniffed and narrowed her eyes. Then she reached out, pointed the knife's tip at his face, drew it slowly back, and passed the blade across her own throat, left to right. He swallowed. "Yeah, we get it." She nodded. Instantly, the boy with the green lights shuffled crabwise out of their path, though he glared at them, as though this hadn't gone down the way he'd wanted. On the next little landing, 3 more trolls stepped back to let them pass. Solix kept looking straight ahead. He glimpsed a chunky fang on a leather cord, a row of glinting rings through a lower lip, wire sprouting like hair from an expansive skin. He could smell food cooking and the tang of cheap soap ore. A little higher up, Teresi said, very quietly, "Thank you for that, Mr. Captor." "Well, fuck," he said, out of the side of his mouth. "It was that or die. I mean, even you couldn't fight all those guys." "Yes, I could," she said, "and in fact I was about to." He risked a glance left and down at her. Her expression was almost too calm. There was something intent about it, something too tightly controlled. He curled his fingers at his hip in sudden hunger. "Teresi," he said, "there's like 50 people on this staircase, and I think they're all armed." 50 people on a staircase is no different to 2 people on a staircase, she said. It just takes longer, unless they have guns, and no one here has guns. They fell quiet as they passed another knot of hulking trolls. One was patting a 3-foot lug wrench thoughtfully against the leg of his jeans. They have wires in the back of their necks, he muttered. Not plugs. Tangles of wire and a kind of little metal cylinder thing. Kids down there all had it, too. You know what that means?
Tell me.
They're wired for network, he said. House mind. I'd heard about feral stems doing this, thought it was just street chaff. They're autonomous most of the time, but if they trip a switch, bam, you got 50 trolls hooked up to a localized combat AI. One mind, 50 fists. You want to fight that on a staircase?
Deeply, she said, and clutched for a quick second at his wrist, tight. That is why I said thank you.
They carried on up the stairs in silence. There was only one door at the top of the tower. It was a sturdy metal construction, daubed with paint in seemingly abstract designs, and it hung very slightly open. Dazzling green-white light poured out of the cracks, leeching everything else of definition. Rose, can you turn the optics off? He thought, and instantly the world was normal colors again, which was to say everything was dark except for the flickering yellow glow around the edge of the door. Terezi pushed it open, and a wash of warm air hit them. It smelt of smoke and wax and spices. The room inside was big and bare. Candles and saucers had been placed around the walls at intervals, a random assortment of shapes and colors, some burnt down to little more than hummocks of tallow, others still tall and straight. The floor was polished boards of synthetic timber, and the windows were hidden behind thick red drapes of what looked like real velvet. He looked up to see dozens of small objects hanging from the ceiling, colorful feathers, small bones, charms of bent metal or greenish glass which twinkled in the light. The air was heavy with some kind of incense, a rich, woody smell that reminded Salix of the pine forest they'd trekked through on the way to the old shelter. Everywhere little flames jumped and danced, shadows swaying on the painted walls. It was the warmest place he could remember being. Not just thermally, the whole room seemed to want to envelop them in heat and light and the love of staying put, the purring cave-dweller voice that says, "Don't go outside, it's cold, and there are monsters." Rose said, "Be careful." He said, "What?" And one of the shadows leapt. There was a clang. Something hit him in the chest, and he went sprawling backwards, banging his elbows painfully on the boards. Terezi's cane was up, and a line of light jumped the gap between her hands, and she lunged. 2 trolls. Terezi and someone even smaller than she was, moving fast. He couldn't follow. A blade lashed, clanged, spark spat from somewhere. Terezi sidestepped as the other troll dived past her and twisted up, cutting at her face. He burrowed in his jacket for the Vulturer, tried to remember whether he loaded blue or red. Had he changed it since the villa? Terezi ducked a strike, parried another, pivoted and jammed a leg out hard and straight. There was a crunch and a gleaming arc of flame, and everything stopped. Sulik scrambled to his feet, pistol held out. A girl was lying flat on her back, arms spread, glaring up furiously along the slim blade of Terezi's sword. The point was nestled in the curve of her throat. Curved metal claws had been fitted over each of her fingers, jutting a good 6 inches beyond each tip. They sparkled with the remaining candles. She was breathing hard, ribs rising and falling. She had a small round face, flushed olive green, tangled hair, and an extra pair of ears sticking up from her skull. "You are fast, Catgirl," said Terezi admiringly, "but you are nowhere near as fast as me." The girl hissed. "Whoa, whoa," said Salix weakly, rubbing his chest where Terezi had shoved him. "Everybody calm the fuck down, all right? I'm too tired for this ninja bullshit. At this point, I will seriously just trank you both and have a fucking beer." The girl on the floor tried to turn her head to glare at him, but couldn't move it far enough with the sword point tucked against her windpipe. "You won't hurt him! I'll kill you! No one's going to hurt him, not ever!" "For fuck's sake," he said, and lowered the pistol, which seemed to surprise her. "We don't even want to hurt him. Being your pizza guy must be a fucking laugh riot." The cat girl blinked. She looked genuinely confused. "My associate is quite correct," said Terezi brightly. "We have no wish to hurt anybody at the moment, but people keep trying to hurt us. I am going to take my sword away now. If you try to do anything exciting, I will cut off both your hands, so please move slowly." And she stepped back a couple of paces, clearing a decent distance between herself and the girl on the floor, although she didn't put the sword away. The girl clambered up into a sort of crouch and squatted on the floor, looking backwards and forwards between the two of them with huge wide eyes and quick little jerky movements of her head. Selleck stared at her. She looked like three separate city fashion trends of the last 6 months had got into a fight and then all gone home together. Clumpy black knee-high boots with fat silver zips, neon pink fishnet tights with torn holes on the calves and knees, a pleated miniskirt in blue and green check, a big, shapeless jacket, muddy green with wide shoulder straps and brass buttons, hanging open over a mesh top emblazoned with some kind of design in rainbow colors he couldn't see properly. With her arms down, the jacket sleeves almost covered her hands, so that only the gleaming blades of the claws showed. Loops of thin chain hung from the waistband of the skirt, to no apparent purpose. "Nya," she said, worriedly. Then she bit her lip and said, "Can you help him?" "Help with what?" said Selleck, a little nonplussed at seeing the spitting fury drain away so fast. "Oh, he's so sick!" she cried, and scratched agitatedly at the boards with one set of claws. "He's really, really pearly, and I've tried everything, but I can only make him better for a little while. I can't fix him. He's fine, really, most of the time, and it's not his fault. He's so sweet, but when it happens, he doesn't... I can't talk to him. He just gets so upset. It's pawful!" "Pawful?" echoed Terezi disbelievingly. "Shit," said Selleck. "Slow down. We can try and help, I guess. What's your name?" "Oh," she looked startled. "Nepeta. Nepeta Lejon." "Okay, well," he said. "I'm Selleck's captor. This is Terezi Paropi. If you take us to the Prophet, we'll do our best, okay?" And he thought, "Rose, can you upload medical diagnostics if I need them?" "Certainly," said the voice. "I have everything from basic first aid to advanced neurosurgery up here, although I wouldn't recommend you attempt the latter without some practice." "Yeah, it's not going to come to that. I just want to be able to tell if this dude's got stomach flu or cancer." The cat girl had bounded across the room to the wall left of the entrance and carefully dragged back one particular swatch of dusty velvet to reveal another heavy steel door. It was painted in bright red with what looked like a caste symbol. Two ovals, top left and bottom right, with curved lines extending out past each other, like the beginnings of planetary orbits. They followed her through the door. The space beyond was just as warm, but darker and much smaller. A few fat yellowy candles had been stuck in little wall niches, which looked like they'd been chipped out by hand, especially for the purpose. There was no furniture. The rich scent of wax from the candles couldn't drown out the sour smell of old sweat. In the center of the room there was a rough wooden pillar, as thick as a good-sized tree trunk, rising almost to the ceiling, and leaning with his back to the pillar was a short, stocky troll with a mess of damp, spiky hair and two horns so stubby they were hardly more than bumps. He wore only a pair of high-waisted black jeans, and the skin of his arms and chest gleamed wet in the dancing light. He was standing awkwardly, with his arms behind him like he was trying to wrap them round the pillar, and it took Selleck a couple of seconds to realize they were bound like that with thick, knotted rope. He raised his chin off his chest to look at them. They were dark bags beneath his eyes, and his face was creased with fatigue. He didn't look well. "Get them out," the Prophet mumbled, through lips that barely moved. "They can't. No, no, they can't come in here. They mustn't. Get them out. Get them out!" His voice spiked to a snarl of desperation, and then his head snapped up so hard it hit the pillar with a thud, and his eyes screwed tight shut. He made a choking sound. "Carcat!" cried Nepeta, panicked. "Holy shit," said Salix, and took a step forward on instinct. Then the prophet sagged. The straining tension went out of his arms, and his head drooped a little, and he let out a long, shaky breath, and he opened his eyes and looked at them again. Both eyes had turned a brilliant, shining green. Nepeta squeaked. Salix lifted his foot uncertainly, caught between staying stock still and hurling himself at Terezi. But the prophet broke into a wide, delighted smile that didn't suit his face at all and said, "Oh my God!" He stepped forward, spreading his arms. The ropes coiled and twisted in the air, writhing like snakes, before flopping to the floor. He said, "Rose!" And before Salix had even remembered to step into a flawless elbow block and then break the arm, he found himself being hugged tightly by a sweaty troll whose head came up to about the middle of Salix's chest. He managed. The prophet let go and beamed up at him, eyes blazing emerald, then turned to look past him. "Dave!" he positively squealed, and Salix turned to see Terezi getting almost flattened by a similarly enthusiastic full-body hug. Her face was a mask of horror. "I missed you guys so much," declared the prophet, letting her go. "Oh my God, I thought I might never see you again." Then he saw Nepeta, whose eyes were now so comically wide they threatened to engulf her face, and said contritely, "Nepeta, I'm so sorry. I haven't done anything bad to him, I promise. He's right here. I just needed to say hello to my friends. I haven't seen them for years. I mean, sweeps." "Salix," said Rose's calm voice, "this is my very dear friend Jade, or the witch, as this universe calls her. Could you perhaps lean in and give her a kiss for me? Tenderly, on the mouth?" "No," he thought. "Was it you?" said Nepeta, shakily. "Have you been hurting him all this time?" "No," said the prophet, sounding indignant. "Well, I mean, sort of, but it wasn't my fault. If he wasn't such a pig-headed, stubborn butt all the time, he'd have been fine. But every time I tried to talk to him, he just got angry and his head filled up with swear words and..." "Neural interference," said Salix. "Yeah, I caught it too. Less fierce by the sound of it, but if you've got two minds in the same head trying to think in opposite directions, you've got problems." "I never had any problems," said Terezi, surprised. "You guys must just get on, I guess," he said, and grinned when she stuck her tongue out at him.
"I don't understand what anybody's talking about," wailed Nepeta.
"Hey, it's okay, it's okay," said the prophet, and patted her on the head. Her face went almost as green as his eyes, and Salix instinctively averted his gaze. "I'll explain everything. Why don't we all have some dinner? Karkat's really hungry."